politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'd say one of the biggest things that skeeves me out about facial recognition is the fact that once your face is in the system, you can't get it back out again.
Why?
Just because once they have a scan of your face, that is something that you can't really get it off of a database. No one who takes that information is going to say, oh, we don't need that anymore, and then just delete it.
So, but the other thing is, I mean, if they aren't accurate, that doesn't matter.
What does matter?
No, if you say the facial recognition systems aren't accurate, then who cares? Like, yeah, sure, I look like... Do you know how many people walk up to me and think I'm the dude who owns Pilgrim Surf Shop in Brooklyn? A lot.
Wait, you're not the dude that owns Pilgrim Surf Shop
in Brooklyn? No, that dude's name is Chris and I'm Bo and we're two different people, but we look alike. My point is that, you know, if it doesn't work, you know, who cares? What's the point?
Well, if the Chris in question were to decide to kill someone or steal something or what have you, and the cops are looking
nice
for you.
Guy. No, but I mean, but then I could say like, yeah, but your facial recognition system is crap.
Well, that's great. That's what your lawyer has to say while you're in custody.
Oh, I got you. Is there any, like, what's the upshot? Is there anything that is being done to like deal with that? Or are we just living in a dystopia?
There are a number of cities now that are starting to back away from facial recognition technology.
And there's also clothing that camouflages you against it.
Clothing?
Yeah, like a shirt or a jacket that has sort of a geometric pattern on it that throws off facial recognition scanners.
You know what's so funny about Travis Adam is that he actually, I wonder sometimes if he actually thinks the show is to help criminals. Good tip, Trav.
I'm here to help.
Well, sometimes you have to think like a criminal in order to avoid being taken by a criminal. I mean, when you and I were writing the book Swiped, we were wondering whether we were giving people a how-to-it guide.
I wasn't wondering about it. I was pretty sure that we were being, half our readership was criminals, but oh well.
Also, I mean, criminals do have a vested interest in keeping their privacy.
That they do.
Oh, well.
For all the wrong reasons, but yeah.
Criminals who are listening to the show, welcome. Don't ever tell anyone that we helped you.
So to all the criminals and consumers who are listening... Welcome to What the Hack, a show about hackers, scammers, and the people they go after. I'm Adam, cyber curiosity seeker.
I'm Bo, cyber bookmark.
And I'm Travis, cyber freak.
And today we talk to one of the world's leading privacy experts, the only three-term commissioner of information and privacy for Ontario, Canada, Dr. Anne Kavoukian.
This spring, get out there, enjoy the weather, and recapture the magic of riding a bike with Electric E-Bike.
With an amazing variety of models built for riders of all abilities, it's never been easier to fall in love with riding again. Plus, every Electric E-Bike ships free and only requires quick, toolless assembly.
This is my first ever e-bike, and the experience has just been great. I was a little bit intimidated at first because I hadn't gone biking in a while, but the 500-watt motor that the Electric E-Bike comes with really gives you a nice little boost, especially if you're trying to go uphill or pick up some speed.
Data shows that e-bike riders take their bike out more often. That means you get more exercise, more exploration, and wait for it, fresh air.
And riding an e-bike isn't like, it's not cheating. It's just making it possible for you to be out there longer on each ride. And speaking of things going a little slower, you can finance Electric E-Bike for as little as $49 a month.
Get into spring with Electric E-Bikes, the number one selling e-bikes in the nation. Get your adventure started at electricebikes.com. And please mention that What the Hack with Adam Levin sent you in the post-checkout survey.
That's electricebikes.com.
So here's the deal. I use Yahoo Finance. I use it to make money because it works. Not just because they're a sponsor of the show. Heck, I've been using them for years before they ever called to become a sponsor. I do a lot of investing, and I need to make split-second financial decisions, and that's where Yahoo Finance comes in. I trade stocks, and I trade options, and you can't trade them in a vacuum. You've got to know what's going on. Yahoo Finance gives you the opportunity to look at the whole picture. I mean, breaking news, editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts. I love the customizable charts. They have it all. At Yahoo Finance, I'm part of a community of over 90 million users. You heard me. 90 million folks use Yahoo Finance because they're helping you on your way to financial success. Visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. That's yahoofinance.com, yahoofinance.com. Dr. Ankavukian, welcome to our show. How are you?
A pleasure, Adam. It's been far too long.
I totally agree with you. All right. So first of all, Anne, where are you coming to us from right now?
I'm in Toronto. My home is in Toronto, Canada. And it's a beautiful day, but it's getting hot. And, you know, I was only four when we came here to Canada. I was born in Cairo in Egypt. And obviously it gets very hot there. I don't remember it, but my mother used to say, it's so much cooler here in Canada.
So what was your family doing in Cairo when you were born?
Okay, really quick story. I'm sure you've all heard about the Armenian genocide.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course.
1915.
Okay.
My grandparents were in the prison, were about to be killed the next morning. My father would have been 3 years old. So I love this story. He was an amazing painter and he was trying to think of how can I save my family? And then my grandmother telling me, and she said, we always used to carry parchment paper and charcoal because he loved to etch. So during that night, she held a candle. He etched a portrait of General Pasha, who was the Turkish general he'd seen earlier in the day. And when the next morning, they're carting him off to be killed. And he said, please give this, says to the soldier, give this to General Pasha with my regards. And the general goes, stupid man, what's he going to want to do with this? So my grandfather thought that was it. On horseback comes riding General Pasha, waving the parchment paper, saying, who did this? I want to know who did this. And my grandfather says, Effendi, that's sir in Turkish, I did it. He said, I like it very much. You and your family, you're free to go. Can you imagine?
Wow.
See?
I use that as an example of how, forget about looking at the odds, never give up on what you believe in. So anyway, my parents wanted to give thanks to God. They went to the Armenian quarter in Jerusalem, you know, the old quarter. One of the quarters is the Armenian quarter. And they went to the cathedral there. And my granddad said, God has saved our life. What can I do? And he said, well, if you can fix, there was a beautiful cathedral in the Armenian quarter, but it was horrible. He said, if you can restore some of these frescoes and things, that would be great. So he spent 2 years there. Grandpa restored everything. I went there years later for a conference in Jerusalem, and I went, and the cathedral was open, and the guy here wrote to the guy there, and they showed me everything my grandfather had done. It was amazing. Anyway, at the end of that, they were in Cairo, very close by, and there was a big Armenian community there, and that's where they lived until I was 4 years old. Abdel Nasser came in. It used to be under British rule, Cairo, but then they went out. Abdel Nasser came in, and my mom said everything changed. Freedom went out the door. Armenians value freedom, obviously, enormously. My father, who was a very well-known photographer, was appointed the official photographer of Nasser, which meant he had no freedom whatsoever. And they literally left in the dead of the night one night. My mother used to say, 8 suitcases, 3 children, and 2 grandmothers, and came to Canada. And my dad's big camera, back then cameras were huge, a colleague of his from somewhere in Europe had come to visit him. And he said, can I ship this to you? And when I'm ready, will you ship it to Canada? He said, yes. And that's how they did it. He shipped it to this guy. We came over here. And eventually, the colleague was wonderful. He shipped it to Dad here in Toronto, and away it goes. Okay, sorry, too much story.
Well, no. And just two other little factoids is that in addition to being an extremely internationally respected individual yourself,
you
have one brother who is a very famous singer-songwriter for children.
Rafi.
Rafi.
Yeah.
And
he's so dear to me.
And your other brother is a very well-known and highly respected photographer as well.
That's right. My oldest brother, Onnig, that's O-N-N-I-G, he worked with my dad to start a photography studio here in Canada, and it just took off. And then my brother continued it after my father died. And so I've got a wonderful photographer as a brother, a wonderful singer. And we applaud each other always. I mean, I was going to say we have sibling rivalry, but in the nicest way, we always are applauding each other to everyone else. Love is great.
And Rafi is a world's renowned, he's a world famous singer,
no? Should we sing Baby Beluga together?
Yeah, he is. I'm so proud of him.
No, in his field, he's world famous. Her brother, Kavuk, is I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah,
is world famous. And Ann, you are world famous. I mean, you were the Information and Privacy Commissioner of Ontario. And in fact, the longest serving.
Three terms. I'm the only one who stuck it out three terms. I loved it.
17 years and 7 months.
Very good, Adam.
But Ann, you come from this family in the arts, and they're very heavily in the arts. I'm curious, how does somebody who comes from such an arts-heavy background get involved in cybersecurity?
I was the only intellectual in our family, so to speak. And my mother, I'll never forget when I was young, she said this to me. She said, Annie, I don't care what you choose to do in your life. I will support whatever you choose to do. But whatever you do, you have to excel at, because there are very few Armenians left worldwide. And we have to show the world we really know how to do things. I'll never forget that. And I said, well, I'm very interested in legal issues and psychology. And then I learned coding and how do you get things going. So I just went through here at the University of Toronto, straight through, did my master's, my PhD, and just loved it and wanted to apply it to privacy, because privacy is so important to me. It forms the foundation of our freedom. And without it, you have nothing to me. So that's what I've been pushing all along. And I also love to tell people, get rid of the zero-sum mindset of privacy versus security or privacy versus data utility. That's so yesterday. You have to have both. You have to have hand-in-hand privacy and data utility and security and everything.
Can you explain what you mean by a data utility?
Whatever the data is intended to do. And literally, there's a wide swath. I mean, marketing, privacy and marketing in terms of data utility. Believe it or not, once a year, the Canadian Marketing Association has their annual conference. They often invite me to be their opening keynote speaker. And I always start by saying, I'm sure I'm the least popular speaker here today. And fortunately, they laugh. And I say, look, I want to tell you how to do marketing so that you don't tick off all your customers. You get their consent to do things, and then they'll point you to what they're interested in receiving, and it will increase the value of what you're doing. So a data utility, make whatever data you have as useful as possible to you and strongly privacy protected. You can do both. So that's what I love doing. I show people how to do this.
When was it? How many years ago was it that you first became interested in consumer privacy?
Okay, I'm going to give you a little bit of my background. Much to my parents' chagrin, I left home when I was 17. I was very rebellious. And I went and I worked actually for a marketing company. I really loved it. And I did a lot of technical work for them, research. You know, we used to do public research. And there I learned that this particular marketing agency, and maybe others at the time, that they didn't respect people's privacy. They did whatever they wanted with the information they collected and used it in ways that were never intended. And given my background as well, I always thought you had to be very sensitive towards people's requests and needs in terms of their personal information. So that was a turnoff to me. I remember going home to my parents on a Sunday for family meal, and I was very annoyed. And at that time, they happened to have invited a professor from the University of Ottawa. And he could see I was annoyed. He could see I was interested in learning things.
So this was at least in 1999.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah. And this is before most people really, it was on your radar before it was on most people's radar.
It was a combination of my background and how important privacy is. Like my grandmother used to say, she said people would always look over their shoulders, be very careful about what they said, because they said if you weren't careful, if you said anything against the Turks, they killed you right on the spot. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but to them, privacy was critical, that you control who hears what you say and what you do and how you do it. So this was infused in me from like childhood. And then I applied that, obviously, all the information society we live in, all the online communications and activity. But I never wanted to make privacy a negative in terms of it will prevent you from doing things.
Right.
No, you do both. That's why I created Privacy by Design. So I won't talk about it yet, but that's how it all started.
Well, no, and that's important because we're living in what is clearly a surveillance economy. So yes, that must give you nightmares.
It does, but I tell people you don't give up on privacy just because surveillance is mounting, especially in the online world. I always say to people, you never say no to groups that you think might not be doing the best job at privacy. You help them. You raise the bar. You show them how to do it. And so when I created Privacy by Design, that's why I did it. I wanted something that was proactive, that could be embedded into the design of your operations, bake it into the code so that you could ideally prevent the privacy harms from arising. And at the time when I was appointed privacy commissioner for the first time, I went to the office and there's like dozens of brilliant lawyers, right? And they're all telling me how they do privacy, which is to apply the law after there's a privacy infraction or data breach and then you want to remedy it. All that's valuable. I said, but I want to prevent it. Ideally, I want to be upfront, proactive, try to prevent it. And they just looked at me like, are you kidding? So literally over three nights at my kitchen table, I created Privacy by Design.
I just got back from France and there was a lot of stuff I couldn't stream because I was in the wrong region. But using NordVPN, I was able to stream everything.
I use NordVPN too, but it's more to protect my private data, like bank details, passwords, and online identity. There are a million trackers online that are just sort of watching you, and NordVPN is a great way to get around those.
NordVPN can switch your virtual location, allowing you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price.
If you're traveling and you're using public Wi-Fi, NordVPN can protect you wherever you are.
It's not just that. NordVPN also comes with threat protection, which helps protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites.
NordVPN is the fastest VPN in the world, and it'll only set you back the price of a cup of coffee a month.
To get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/WTHack.
And hey, there's no risk. It's a 30-day money-back guarantee.
Check the link in the podcast description.
If we start at the beginning on Privacy by Design, how did you come up with the actual concept, Privacy by Design, and how long did it take for it to take shape?
I had been appointed privacy commissioner, and I've been thinking about these things for a long time at my kitchen table, literally with my husband, who's a brilliant, PhD neurophysiology. He's like brilliant. He knows everything. And so I was always talking to him about this stuff. So the interest in coding and learning how to embed things into design arose from my conversations with my husband. And so when I took this to the office, as I said, it was foreign to them because they were lawyers. I mean, they just studied the law and this was all very foreign to them. And so literally at my kitchen table at home over three nights talking with my husband, I came up with Privacy by Design, the seven foundational principles. And then I went to the office and literally sold it. I had to sell it to my lawyers, but they got it. I wasn't saying forget the law. No, strong laws are very important. But I was saying, let's minimize our need to rely on the law, if right from the outset at the design stage, proactively, you can prevent the harms from arising. And that sold, and then it took off.
What are the seven principles?
First one, be proactive. You want to prevent the privacy harms from arising as opposed to offer remediation after the fact. The second principle is privacy as the default setting. This is huge. This has also been included in the GDPR in Europe. Privacy as the default setting means you don't have to wait for your customers to ask you for strong privacy measures. No, you don't put the pressure on them to, you know, wade through your terms of service and all the legalese and the privacy policy, saying, please do not use my personal information for any purpose other than the primary purpose of the data collection that I've consented to, which is right, this collection here. No, very few people do that anymore. You know, life is short, but it doesn't mean they don't care about privacy. Privacy is at an all-time high in terms of concern. In the last 2 years, all of the public opinion polls, Pew Internet Research, et cetera, have put privacy concern at the 90 percentile. 90% very concerned about their privacy. 92% concerned about loss of control over their information. So anyway, back to privacy as the default setting. What that is, it's you say to your customers, no, you don't have to ask for privacy. You don't have to find where do I check the box. We give it to you automatically. It's the default setting. We are only permitted to use your personal information for the primary purpose of the data collection that you've consented to. If we want to use it down the road for a secondary use, we have to come back to you and ask for additional consent. This sells like anything. This builds trust like no other at a time when trust is fleeting. And it's just been hugely, hugely successful. Okay, that's number two. Number three, privacy must be embedded into design, because you don't want people to forget about it. You want it in the design of what you're doing. Bake it into the code. You know, I always ask companies, do you have a data map? And they go, huh? See, usually the first instance where privacy is collected, some kind of permission consent is obtained, but then it wades through the company and goes to different departments and is used for other secondary uses that have not been consented to. So privacy embedded into design means it can only be used for this purpose, and additional consent will be required for additional purpose.
So what we're saying, first of all, is proactive.
Yeah.
Secondly, it must be
default setting.
Default setting.
Embedded in design.
Embedded in design.
Oh my gosh. So you obviously were looking at Facebook, now Meta. And you were just kind of describing the way they did privacy because they did it so perfectly.
Bo, can I tell you something? In
yes.
The early years, Mark Zuckerberg invited me down to California to talk to his team. He'd heard about my privacy by design work.
Yeah.
Back in early years or 2000s or whatever. And he was really interested in privacy. That was before they hired Sheryl Sandberg. So at the beginning.
But I mean, that people saw that it was a marketing point, that you actually could market the idea that you were private. Are you sure they were wearing no earplugs or something? You know, it sounds to me like I feel like they must not have heard you.
They thought they could build trust and get people to come and join Facebook and it would grow. Unfortunately, uh-huh. When Sheryl Sandberg came on, the model changed completely, the marketing model. And I left and I just said enough.
And what was okay. How did it change? How would you describe the change?
She wanted to get everybody's personal information. She had no interest in privacy, and marketing was all she wanted to do without any privacy consideration.
Got you.
And so I left. Okay. Number four is full functionality. Now, this may seem odd to you, but what I hate is the zero-sum mindset of privacy versus security, or privacy versus data utility, or the versus, you know, either or. Zero-sum is one wins, one loses. It's the win-lose model. And it's never privacy that wins, but nor should it be anything else that wins in absence of privacy. So I always reject that. And I talk about full functionality, which is positive sum. Positive sum means you can have two positive gains at the same time.
Adam, you have four fingers holding your forehead up, which tells me that you're where I am. Do you understand the zero-sum thing entirely?
I do.
You do? All right. And sometimes I have to ask Travis, who I've been working with since 1997, to explain things to me, because I've become a doddering old man. Travis, explain zero sum to me, please.
If I'm not mistaken, I think the way that we sort of view that is that a zero sum just means that the necessary trade-off for privacy is something where the person whose information is being kept private doesn't get anything out of it. There's no benefit overall.
Well, put.
I think zero sum, at least to me, means in order for someone to win, someone has to lose.
That's right.
And what you're proposing is if you view this as both sides win, because it's a marketing plus, And it's also a protection for the consumer.
So that's not zero.
That's no positive sum.
Oh, that's positive,
positive sum.
I am now educated. I'm now educated. I thank you,
praise
everyone.
The Lord. We've gotten through
I
him.
Finally understand something. This is a good day. All right.
Wonderful. I'm so pleased. That makes me happy.
Thank you. Thank you. I just want, and also I just figured if I don't get it, probably someone listening doesn't get it. But
no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Okay. Now I'm going to go on to number five, end-to-end security. While the term privacy subsumes a much broader set of protections than security alone, if you don't have a strong foundation of security from end to end with full lifecycle protection, you're not going to have any privacy. In this day of phishing attacks and hacking all the time, you must have a very solid, strong foundation of security. So that's number five.
And in that case, would this just be encryption primarily? Or
I always focus on encryption. I love end-to-end encryption, but firewalls, you know, all kinds of things. Okay. Six, visibility and transparency. I tell companies, please keep it open, and to governments, the information you collect from people, it's not yours, it's theirs. They're entrusting it to you. And companies that have come back to me who've become certified for privacy by design, they've come back to me and said, we love this, because what the people do when we open it up, they look at the data we have about them and they say, oh, no, that piece of information, that's no longer true. That was the case 2 years ago. Now here's the correct information. So they said it increases the accuracy of the information we have and the quality that we have. So they love it. The last one is just a general one, respect for user privacy. When you keep it user-centric, focused on the user, all of this unfolds. It becomes just so obvious, and it shows respect for the individual's privacy. That's it. Those are the seven foundational principles. And, you know, you might think, a lot of people hear these and they say, well, it sounds good, but it's going to be too hard to do, right? In real life, it's too hard. Wrong. We have a paper we published while I was still commissioner called Operationalizing Privacy by Design, which is consisting of, I think, 11 papers that we did with companies about different things, you know, biometrics, smart meters, personal data of all kinds, home healthcare, you name it. And it really works. I'll give you one thing we did with Intel and home healthcare. As people get older, they still want to live in their homes, even though they're living alone, but they might need some help once in a while. So Intel worked with us. It's beautiful. They created these sensors that you can put on your bed or wherever you decide to put it. So that, let's say you're living alone in your house, you get up in the middle of the night to use the restroom, you don't return within a predetermined period of time. The sensor goes off, it gets help that you've consented to, you've agreed to at the beginning. But they built privacy by design in it. So nobody else gets this information. It is strongly coded, protected. It only goes to the people you've agreed to have that information sent to, the healthcare provider, the hospital, whatever. And it helps the individual stay at home. So that's just one example. So there are many, many other examples like that. And then in 2010, privacy by design was unanimously passed as an international standard by the International Assembly of Privacy Commissioners and Data Protection Authorities. That was a real honor.
And so you mentioned certification for privacy by design. Yeah. Is that through privacy commissioners, or how does that process work?
It's through myself and KPMG. I partnered with KPMG because I have a consulting service now for the past 2 years, the Global Privacy and Security by Design Center. So when people, I have a website, et cetera. So if people want to be certified for privacy by design, they come to me, and with their consent, I say, I'm going to send your information to KPMG, who will contact you and pour through everything you do to ensure that you are, in fact, following privacy by design. And then when they get certified, they can, you know, wear it on their website, wear it as a badge of honor. Then they said it gives them enormous trust from their customers. It builds trust, it keeps the customers they have, and it attracts new opportunity.
So Anne, what I'm hearing is it's basically the privacy by design standards are similar to the LEED standards. You can be gold, silver, et cetera. Is that right?
This one, it's not as complicated. You either get certified or you don't, because it's much simpler, I think.
But it's used as a marketing point in the same way LEEDs is.
Oh, sure. Sure. Absolutely. Because they're offering the strongest privacy possible to their customers.
So overall, just in the general privacy landscape, what worries you most these days?
Surveillance is mounting enormously, as you know. Mm-hmm. And what I fear is everybody's in a hurry, right? Everybody's rushing around. And the tendency to just say, yeah, sure. It's when you go to a website you're not familiar with, you don't know what they're going to do with your information. People just hurry through things, which I understand. But that's the unfortunate part. It will contribute to the growth of surveillance. And then something happens and your information somehow flows out to unauthorized third parties who would use your information in ways that was never intended. And then away it goes. Plus, apart from that, identity theft. If you are not with a company who protects your data strongly, identity theft is growing enormously. And it's a nightmare. I remember when I was privacy commissioner, victims of identity theft would come to me and say, can you please help me? I didn't rack up all those charges, or that's not me, that's somebody else. And the first thing I used to say to them is, of course, I'll help you, but go to the police first, file an occurrence report, something that validates your claim that your identity has been stolen. And then I would work with them to help them clear their name. But it could take years sometimes. It's a nightmare.
If you were going to identify the one company in the world that you think is doing the best job, or the top three, what would you say? Or are you allowed to say? Or,
oh, you know, Adam, I haven't done that. I'll just tell you off the top, one of the companies that I love, Apple. They go to great lengths to give you end-to-end encryption on your mobile device. I have an iPhone, for example.
Right.
And I also know, I've looked under the hood, they go to great lengths to protect your personal information that they have. So if I had to name one company, it'd be Apple. There are others. There's a company called Identos here in Canada that does investigations of things, but they're totally privacy protective. And, there aren't dozens of these companies, unfortunately.
Well, and you know, the other thing we know, too, is in the old days, when things were created, like, for instance, the electronic health records, the issue was not privacy and security, despite what governments may tell you. The issue was, does it work? And people were incentivized to either, they were disincentivized by, they were penalized if they didn't do electronic health records, and they were incentivized if they did. But
And did they work, Adam?
They worked better than paper files, but they were not secure. That was the whole issue, is they were not secure.
So that to me says they don't work on some very essential level.
Electronic health records are a nightmare, depending on who's doing it. Mm-hmm. They can be used for a variety of purposes that you have not consented to. It can go into other hands for other purposes. And this
is not something that you can deal with just by looking at your explanation of benefits or stuff. I mean, this is behind the scenes, way behind the scenes.
That's wow. Right.
When you were commissioner, this is one of the big issues you dealt with is protected health information, correct?
And we were very lucky in my jurisdiction, Ontario, Canada, we had something called PHIPAA, the Personal Health Information Protection Act. And it allowed me to have great strength in terms of privacy of health information in my jurisdiction. So we just insisted upon this, that consent is essential. The patient has to know how you're using your information. Obviously, for your healthcare provider, your general practitioner, your family doctor, you go to him, you want help, you want him to refer it to some specialist, and you're going to get some tests. And all of that is great and should be allowed, because the person is you know, in a risky state and they're nervous and stuff. So we said we wanted it to work. Again, not zero sum. So we said, okay, you go to your healthcare provider for seeking his or her assistance. They can share it with other healthcare providers that they're going to refer you to that you have consented to, right? Right. So that's fine. They can do that automatically. But the minute the information, your health information, is in any way intended to go outside of healthcare, the walls go up. You must give positive consent or you can't send the information. We've had great success with this.
How do you feel about facial recognition technology?
Oh, I hate it. I hate it for a number of reasons. First of all, it's most of the time it's not accurate. They use facial recognition extensively in Britain, in the UK, and 83% of the time, it's a false positive. So can you imagine? 83% of the time, it says, yeah, it's you, and it's not you. It's a false positive. It can ruin, I mean, it could just do such damage to your life.
But so, the phone, speaking of which, the Apple phone, it's 100% of the time works. So where's the one to one?
That's the difference, Bo.
Oh.
One to many is my face being compared to hundreds of thousands of people in the population.
I got you. So one it's like when you go and Google, when you do a Google search on an image and you get like, I'm like, look, here's me. Can you find me? And they're like, yeah, here's 1,850-year-old men with salt and pepper hair. Yeah.
But that's exactly it. One to one is brilliant. It's me against my iPhone, like you said.
Yeah.
I have a Nexus card. Not that I'll be traveling anytime soon. It's so crazy. But I used to travel to the States a lot. Nexus helped me enormously because they use my facial recognition. When I go to the Nexus thing at the airport, they compare my live face to the image they have, which I consented to, one to one. That's the difference, Bo. One to many is a nightmare.
What are some basic and practical things that people can use to protect their privacy just in their everyday life?
Do not disclose your information to third parties unknown. And, you know, I say that and people go, yeah, but, you know, I'm going online all the time. I want information. I just say yes to cookies, yes to everything. That's one of the biggest problems. If you allow your information to flow and in context of whatever you're doing, then, and you're not careful with what you consent to, I can guarantee it's going to go to third parties unknown that are not authorized to collect your data. When you go, let me give you a physical example. You go into a real life store, like in the world, you go into the store and you buy something with your credit card. Often they take your credit card, you make the payment, and they might say, here in Canada, they say, what's your postal code? I, of course, always say, what would you like the postal code for? I'm really curious about that. I don't know how that affects my privacy. The minute I ask the question, the clerk doesn't know what I'm talking about. They go get the manager. The manager comes back and says, oh, you care about privacy. We can do this, this, and this. It immediately elevates their protection of your data. So I always tell everybody, the one thing you can do at the beginning of any of these, express your interest in privacy right at the beginning. It'll take you down a different path. And I'm not saying you're going to get perfect data protection, but you will get stronger data protection than if you don't raise it.
So if someone is a cynic and they say, hey, I don't have a problem giving up my privacy for convenience. Why should people care about protecting their privacy?
I love it. It's like, I have nothing to hide. What's the big deal? I don't have a problem with that because it's going to come back and bite you in ways you couldn't have anticipated. You don't know how information about you can be used to harm you in ways you can't possibly anticipate. That's what I learned when I was privacy commissioner for such a long time. I couldn't imagine all the different ways that unknown third parties could use your data that could cause you harm. So it's not about wanting to hide anything. I would say privacy is about control. It's about personal control over the use and disclosure of your personal information. If you want to give it out to the world, be my guest. That's your right. As long as you make the decision to do so, it's critical. It resonates with people when I'm talking. The Germans have a wonderful term called informational self-determination, that it should be the individual who determines the fate of his or her personal information. And they know from experience what a huge difference this can make. You can't anticipate how things can happen to you. Just know that they will. And just take a little additional measure, express your concern for privacy and your interest, and it will elevate your protection dramatically. See, the reason it's so important for the individual to consent, to have control over the use and disclosure of their information, is because context is key. Nobody knows the context associated with the data other than the individual. Something to one person may not be sensitive at all. To another person, it may be extremely sensitive because their context is different. So I always say to people, to companies, you don't know the context associated with the data. So that's another reason why it's very important to ensure that the data are consented to by the individual. And again, the German informational self-determination arose from that mindset as well.
Well, listen, we could go on forever. And we will come back and go on forever.
I hope you do. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you all.
But we really, really appreciate what you've said. And heaven knows you've had an incredibly stellar career.
Oh, thank you. I've been very lucky.
You guys, you do realize Ann Cavoukian is a legend.
She's a rock star when it comes to privacy and security.
Was Rafi ever a rock star?
Well, he's a children's rock star.
Okay, so there's like, it's all rock stars. Throw a rock, hit a rock star in
their
family.
Actually, he's a folk star.
Like pop star maybe at best. Yeah.
We have to have her back because I didn't even get to talk to, one of the questions that I wanted to ask her about was whether or not my phone is listening to me, which I'm quite sure it is. And Travis, thank you for not saying that I probably Googled whatever it is I think my phone heard.
All right, friends. It's time now for the Tinfoil Swan, our paranoid takeaway that'll help keep you safe online.
Right. So like when you get, you know, the rest of your food from the restaurant, you take it home and the tinfoil swan, take the tinfoil apart, put it on your head and you're safe. Correct?
No. Not so much.
Okay, fine. So what is our tip this week? What do we want to talk about?
Our tip this week has to do with Twitter privacy.
Oh, that sounds like an oxymoron. It's sort of like military intelligence.
Jumbo shrimp.
How do you do it?
It's fortunately pretty straightforward. You just go to settings and privacy when you're logged into Twitter. And then once you're there, you click on the privacy and safety tab. And then there's a little sliding bar next to protect your tweets, which means that your tweets will be private.
How far should I slide the bar?
Oh, come on.
All the way.
All the way.
Oh.
So there's another thing that you can do, which is you can just delete your account.
No.
Adam, don't you really want to... How many followers do you have now?
Almost 60,000.
So, you know, that would be a big protest statement. That's like... That is like an auto de fe. You just delete that account, Adam.
I like my Twitter followers.
Okay, never mind.
So, Travis, what's the security benefit for me keeping my Twitter private?
Any information you post about yourself on social media can be used against you, either to hack your accounts or steal your identity. And so by keeping it private, that means that you're putting less personal data out there.
Okay, but it's social media. And, you know, if you have it set private, that means that you're not actually doing what it does.
You're not being social.
That is the oxymoronic situation. That's the paradox, right? Is that, you know, social media is just not a place to be if you want to keep your information private, period. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, rate and review. It helps people find it. And we'll see you next week. What the Hack with Adam Levin is a production of Loud Tree Media.
It's produced by Andrew Steven, the man with two first names.
You can find us online at loudtreemedia.com and on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Adam K. Levin.